This podcast may contain explicit language, and feel free to use explicit language when you review The Gist on iTunes. It helps other people find the show. It's Tuesday, August 13th, 2019. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Maybe you've seen one of these compilation tapes of Joe Biden's recent gaffes going around. If this were the 80s, they'd be sold on late night TV. But we get them for free on Twitter. Here's a select few from, just within the last couple weeks. This is from about a 3-minute clip video. I'll play about four of them.
Poor kids are just as bright and just as talented as white kids.
I found that the secretary, we sat together in many meetings.
My wife is a full-time teacher, taught all during being when we were vice president. We choose truth over facts.
That's what I think my plan. I know what my plan does.
But, you may have heard some analysis that is going around about these gaffes. And it goes like this. Well, what do we expect? Biden always has had gaffes. Or, this is nothing new. Biden gaffed every time he ran for president and as vice president. No. These gaffes, these current gaffes, are qualitatively different. The old Biden gaffes, Biden gaffe classic, if you will, were statements like this.
Romney wants to he said in the first 100 days, he's going to let the big banks once again write their own rules. Unchain Wall Street. They're going to put you all back in chains.
Oh, the right hated that one. But that is what Biden meant to say. He said, unchain Wall Street. His brain went, ooh, maybe there's something to riff on there. And out of his mouth came the exact words that he meant to utter. Was it advisable? Maybe not. Was it rash? You can make the case. But it was what he wanted to say. Then there was this one, speaking to the president, or in Gaelic, the Taoiseach of Ireland.
But the Taoiseach knows a lot about it. His mom lived in Long Island for 10 years or so. God rest her soul. And your mom's still alive as your dad passed. God bless her soul.
Whoops. But again, it is what he wanted to say. He shouldn't have wanted to say it just based on the facts, but he wanted to say it. He was wrong to presume that Cowan's mom was dead and realized it too, unlike Mrs. Cowan, late. Next, let us consider this one.
Now is the time to heed the timeless advice from Teddy Roosevelt. Speak softly and carry a big stick. End of quote. I promise you. The president has a big stick. I promise you.
And Obama's standing there like, well, that's just true. What's the problem with that? No problem there. Yeah. If fact check that one, you might give new meaning to the pants on fire label. But, I guess we could all say that Joe Biden in that case could have used a better choice of words. But that is my point. He did, Biden classic gaffe, did actually rely on him choosing the words. And the words he said up there in his brain came out there through his lips, and maybe he regretted it afterwards or people criticized him for it. But that loop, all the synapses were connected. Something else is going on these days. The current gaffes are of a different quality. They are not the gaffes of the rash. They are the gaffes, we have to admit it, of the cognitively challenged. I can't diagnose exactly what's going on there. Also, keep in mind, Biden, a former stutterer, maybe that has something to do with it. But it's not like the old gaffes. The old Biden gaffe was a gaffe of commission. These are gaffes of omission, as in his mental processing is eliminating some steps so the words aren't coming out as he'd want them to come out, as opposed to the old way, which just meant they weren't coming out in the optimally articulated way. The etymology of the word gaffe is interesting. It's borrowed from French, gaffe. But then it wends its way through Middle French, through Old Occitan, I don't know. But it probably derives from the phrase to seize. And that is actually what's going on with Biden these days. He's seizing up. These gaffes are neurologically misfiring, not logical misstatements. And I do think they're going to keep him from his quest to seize the presidency. On the show today, in the spiel, the worst disease gives us the best news. But first, Maria Konnikova has been known to study a long con to dissect its intricacies, but also to make an instantaneous read at the poker table, where she might calculate pot odds, opponent strategy, and overall tournament placement. Does she have a long attention span or a short one? Or better yet, attention spans. Is that even a legit topic? Maybe I should put it this way. Attention spans. Is that bullshit? Up next. The Defender is a beautiful car, but beauty is, of course, sometimes only skin deep. Not with the Defender. Let's talk about the interior. It's robust, built with integrity. Yes, it's designed iconically, the exterior. That's what compelled me. My neighbor Jay says, Mike, you see what's on the block? It's a Defender. And I look down the block, and indeed there is. And me and Jay, the neighbor, and Michelle, we gather around the Defender. We peer in the window. I have to say, I don't want to make this a little too tawdry, but we lust, or perhaps we kvel. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. We looked at the cargo capacity, more room for the gear. There's really a wide range of adventures. The Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender. So the other day I was thinking, squirrel, no, I wasn't. It's just that, like so many people in the modern world, my attention span is not what it was or what I hope it would be or what some mythical notion of attention span tells me it should be, which is, you know, reading Middlemarch from start to finish without ever looking at my phone. Joining me now is Maria Konnikova, who is literally right now looking at her phone.
I am.
What's on it?
Do you know why? Why don't you see what's on it?
It is squirrel hoarding.
Yes, I was looking up the statistics after you said squirrel of what percentage of nuts that squirrels hoard, they forget where they hoarded them.
So you were quickly, one word triggered something. You quickly had to flit away to that thing it reminded you of.
Exactly.
I think this is a great way to be. I mean, this is why I do this show. But let me properly introduce you in case our listeners have a sufficient attention span to attend to this information. Maria Konnikova is the author of The Confidence Game, and she is author of the forthcoming The Biggest Bluff. She also joins us to talk in our segments called Is That Bullshit? And today we will play Is That Bullshit? Are Attention Spans Shrinking? Thank you for coming in, Maria.
Thank you so much. And I was not able on that one website to find the answer to the squirrel hoarding question, but I remember reading it, and it's something like squirrels forget 70% of all nuts, something along those
very
lines.
Small
it was
brains.
It was a huge percentage, and I just thought it was the funniest thing in the world.
So what happens to all those other nuts?
Who knows?
Some other squirrels find them?
Maybe some other squirrels find them. Maybe they become trees.
Yeah, that's right. That's where all the trees come from. So here's what I want to do before we get to the idea of attention spans shrinking. It seems to me that the idea of an attention span might be something of an artificial construct. And it also seems to me that maybe it's recent. I don't know that in medieval times they talked about it. Am I right or wrong? Do you know anything about this?
I do, actually. So, yes, if you're talking about psychologically speaking, there is a specific term known as the attention span. It is a total bullshit construct.
Oh, cool.
Yes. So you're absolutely right. Did they worry about it in medieval times? Absolutely they did. In medieval times, you have...
Well, what with Gutenberg and the kids these days?
So you have texts from monasteries with monks who say that they're distractible around noon and that they lament that they can't focus for as long as they need to on their prayers, and they call this acedia, the noonday demon.
So I guess they say that attention spans are shrinking because we have so many things to grab our attention.
Yep.
Have they been saying this for a while?
They have. So I actually was able to find Walter Benjamin back in 1968 lamenting how books were giving way to movies.
Yes.
And this is in his The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction. And he says that concentration, which is required for true art, is being replaced by distraction.
It is probably
And this
true.
Is horrible.
Yeah.
And this is horrible. And that movies are the devil, basically.
This
he doesn't say that movies are the devil, but... This but is, that's the conclusion.
You know, a good 15 years before the remote control, though. So you absolutely still have to get up to change
absolutely.
The channel.
And this is something that we've heard over, I mean, McLuhan says this, and today we have it, you know, basically from everyone you can read. I was able to find, I think, at least 5 New York Times op-eds from the last 5 years mm-hmm. about our attention span shrinking. And there's a number that's actually bandied about yes. quite often that says that it's shrunk from 12 minutes in 2000 to 8.25 in 2015.
I hate when they express minutes in some in
yes.
decimals.
Yes, because... but this is wrong, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, there's...
That's good. I don't know what to
so
worry
you don't,
about
you
that.
Don't actually have to worry about this because... Yeah. There was one very persistent journalist who tried to track down this statistic, found that it was quoted from Statistic Brain, contacted Statistic Brain, got no reply, tried to figure out where Statistic Brain
what
got it from.
What is Statistic Brain?
It's a website.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So basically, no one knows where this statistic came from, and yeah. there's no study.
Or maybe
that
someone
shows
knows,
it.
But they weren't paying attention.
Yes, exactly. No one was paying attention to yeah. him. And it looks like he really doggedly tried to find it out. So I will defer to him and say that that statistic is not based on any study.
Also, when they say attention span
yep.
is this many minutes, are yep. they saying at that point the median person can no longer pay attention? I don't even think that's what colloquial
yeah.
we mean when we say attention spans
so,
are shrinking.
I couldn't agree more. And no one really defines it. What does it actually mean? So... there was one study that I found. This is kind of the one of the first instances, if not the first. It's the first one that I could find, but I'm not sure it's actually the first mm-hmm. That's been cited as kind of our 10 to 15 minute attention span. This was a 1978 review by Hartley and Davis of note taking during college lectures.
Mm-hmm.
And they found that note taking decreases, but it was actually misquoted in the future because they found that it decreases in the last 10 minutes of the lecture,
yeah.
not after 10 to 15 minutes.
Okay.
And that the reason it decreases is because the content of the lectures tends not to be as note intensive near the end as it was in the beginning.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because you're providing a lot of new information
yeah.
and then you're wrapping up the class.
Right.
And everyone's getting ready to go. So it's not that they've drifted away. That actually the main difference with note-taking and with the amount of attention that students pay happens to be the teacher. And so this is the first instance that I could find of this 10 to 15 minute attention span, and it's not even measuring really attention span.
How else would they study it? How else have they tried? That seems like somewhat clever. Let's look at a class and we'll see.
Yeah, so they've looked at a bunch of stuff.
Did they do the eyeball tracking?
Yeah,
thing?
So eyeball tracking has been done, but that's only good. So this is why it's so hard as a psychologist to study attention span, because you can do eyeball tracking studies for concrete things,
mm-hmm.
but it's very hard to do eyeball tracking and have someone sit in this machine, which is actually very uncomfortable. I've done these. And if you haven't, I don't recommend it. You know, you
I
have
saw
to,
Clockwork Orange. It must be like that.
Yes, it's exactly like that. Imagine doing that for an hour.
Right.
Right. So all of these studies tend to be very short. Like the tasks that you do are a few minutes long.
Right.
And so even though eye tracking is a great measure, it's much more useful for task switching, for multitasking, for those types of things, for distractions. How well do you filter distractions? And less so when it comes to, you know, our attention spans in general. How long are you able to pay attention? And I think the reason that it's so hard to find a way to study it is because the concept doesn't really make sense. All of these questions never get asked. And there's a psychologist whose work I don't think we've talked about in the past called Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, who studies flow, the concept of flow, which is kind of how engaged are you in something? Are you feeling one with it? Are you kind of in the moment? If you're experiencing flow, you can pay attention indefinitely to a lot of things because you can experience flow when you're doing something that requires mastery, but you can also experience it when you're collating letters. If you, you know, if you get into a rhythm and you actually kind of get into
You're in that zone, collation groove.
You know, it has little to do with the complexity of the task and everything to do with your mindset. And when you're in a flow state, you can pay attention forever. And if you're being distracted, if you can't engage, if you're not actually able to get into that state because there are lots of things happening and you can't hook your attention initially, that's when you have distractibility problems. But it's not that you can't pay attention. It's that you basically didn't have the initial engagement to begin with.
Is that different from how it used to be or
what
things were like when we
were
kids?
I think this is why the monks are lamenting it hundreds of years ago, because it's always difficult to hook your attention. Now, what is different today is that there are many more things competing for our attention.
Right.
And so it becomes more difficult for that initial attention hook to happen. I mean, we've always had things competing for our attention. What the modern world does incredibly well is hijack our attention. So when you say, you know, the MTV edits, all of that, it doesn't mean that our attention spans are shorter. It means that they're very good at capturing our attention. And they capture it over and over again. And so we live in a more stimulated and stimulus-laden environment, which makes it more difficult to engage and makes it unnecessary. So for people who've never had deep engagement with anything, they don't realize how that might be actually incredibly rewarding, that they might be able to get something out of it because they've never had to. It's one of these things where if you've never had to be bored, you don't realize that actually, you know, sitting quietly can lead to a lot of creative insights that
so I've
you
heard.
Can have.
I mean, my earbuds are plugged in and
exactly.
fully charged, so I don't have to live through that hell. But
people have always been scared of this, right?
Yes.
When the radio first was invented, people thought, uh-oh, you know, now no one's reading books. Everyone wants to sit and listen to the radio.
Sure. This Green Hornet. You kidding me?
Absolutely.
It's compelling stuff.
So I think that these fears always kind of will come up every generation. I think that, you know, there's always reason for them. And we do need to be aware that this exists. There was one study that was just done by scientists at Cal State, and they looked at middle, high school, and college students who were studying in their natural study environments. So that could be their bedroom, you know, living room, kitchen, wherever they were doing their homework. And they had they basically looked at how well they studied and how much technology they had around them as they studied.
Right.
And so they had things, computer, cell phone, TV, music players, video game consoles, video games. And then they looked at how many windows were open on their computer, if they had a computer, at the beginning of observation. And what exactly was open? Was it Facebook, chat, word processor, PowerPoint, YouTube, etc.? And so they found that basically, in 15 minutes of observation, they were able to stay on task about 65% of the time. So that's 10 out of 15 minutes.
Yeah.
What seemed to predict the ability to pay attention, though, wasn't so much how many things you had around you, and it was more so what your study habits were. So students who had better study habits were better able to study.
Oh, okay. It does seem to me that undergirding these assumptions are that we've changed, but it's since no one has established a baseline. I mean, a couple different things. I guess you could say the kids of the 70s or 80s versus the kids of today, but they're different. They're literally different people.
Yep.
But no one has the baseline. No one did the test of here is the attention span in 1988.
Right.
Here, and how do you do that?
No, and you can't do that.
I think there might be one way,
okay,
which is in the future, if a printed text, it has to be an electronic printed text source like Kindle, can find the statistics of a book that's opened and the pages are read. I guess it could get screwed up if you open the Kindle and don't go through it. But there probably in 10 years will be a way to tell how quickly people went through a book from 2017 versus 2027.
Yeah.
But other than that, I don't know how you really test it.
I don't know. And the only study that actually looked at attention span that had numbers that I could get on board with looked at global attention span, which has nothing to do with individuals' ability to pay attention, but just looked at global trends. Yeah. Basically, how long do Twitter trends last? How long do people talk about certain topics? And they found that that actually decreased.
Yeah, no kidding.
But that's something totally different. That's not individual attention spans. But I could see why someone would look at that and say, oh, we can't pay attention anymore. So they looked at Twitter.
No, the memes have just gotten better.
Exactly.
They're coming fast and furious. So, and we got this guy in the White House. He keeps doing something new every day.
That's exactly right. So in this particular study that was published in Nature Communications, they looked at Twitter right before Trump, 2013 to 2016. And books from Google Books going back 100 years, movie ticket sales, and citations of scientific publications. And then they looked at Google Trends, Reddit, and Wikipedia. And they basically saw that everything tended to decrease a little. So, for instance, in 2013, a hashtag stayed on top in the top 50 for an average of 17.5 hours. And by 2016, it was only 11.9 hours.
Huh.
So hashtags go down and some of the other stuff wasn't statistically significant.
There's a caveat. So our attention spans are shrinking societally as a people's. Is that bullshit?
Bullshit.
All right.
Total bullshit.
I love a nice clean one. Maria Konnikova is the author of The Confidence Game and the forthcoming The Biggest Bluff. Maybe you saw her at the World Series of Poker. I mean, if you were there, that's what she plays cards for a living. She has to pay attention to hand after hand after hand.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
And hopefully
sometimes
you guys will pay attention to The Biggest Bluff for week after week after week.
Thank you, Maria.
Thank you, Mike.
This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where it got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters, and hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And now, the spiel. Oh, we all live in the worst timeline. The world is an unalloyed hellscape. How could you bring children into this world? Yeah, well, suck on this one. We cured Ebola. There is a cure for Ebola. Woo the F who. Here's the BBC.
Scientists working with the World Health Organization say more than 90% of infected people can survive if treated early with the most effective drugs.
The BBC continued on with its interview of Jean-Jacques Mayembed, one of the lead scientists who discovered the cure, an African, by the way.
This is a breakthrough.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it is very important because, as you know, Ebola has no cure, no vaccine. So this is the biggest news of this year.
It is a breakthrough, and it is amazing. On the other hand, we still do have Ebola. Ebola, one of the worst diseases imaginable, has killed 1,800 people in a horrible, horrible way. Your body basically eats itself. And the cure isn't a vaccine. You have to seek treatment early. And if you don't get it, you still have Ebola. But still, maybe one day, and that day is closer now than we ever thought, Ebola will join the world
of the treatable disease, the disease that we've all but eradicated. Diseases like yellow fever, malaria, rinderpest, and hookworm. Yet, you know, we all take these achievements and these eradications for granted. How for granted? Well, I just made up one of the aforementioned diseases, and it wasn't rinderpest, it was malaria. It doesn't matter how many lives we save, or the marvels of science. Cue the depressive cynic, the real-life Daria droning on about what's the point. We've left an all-but uninhabitable world marked by diseases, starvation, war, and deprivation. The four horsemen of the apocalypse. We're so sure things are so terrible. How sure are we that they're terrible? I'll tell you how sure. I made up one of those horsemen. Those aren't the four horsemen. It's three of the four horsemen. Deprivation, not a horseman. Sure, it's bad, but the fourth horseman of the apocalypse is conquest. Kind of a weird horseman, right? It's bad for the conquered, but maybe a boon for the conquering. I mean, the other ones, we don't have any sort of positive associations with famine or death. There are no college fight songs with famine in them, yet Michigan has this. Hail to the disease vectors. Hope you find a cure. Die, die, die. So what I'm saying is, what I'm always saying is, news isn't only bad. To qualify as news, it can be good, or if it is good, it could qualify as the most important news. You should pay attention to all of it. And also know that the stuff that's not even news, just the background noise of gradual improvement, that's real too. Which is why I went to the BBC's Africa YouTube channel, trying to find a nice uplifting video to really explain how the Ebola cure went down. Here's what I found. This was the first story, the top story, on the Africa page of the BBC.
Codeine cough syrup is causing a plague of addiction across Nigeria.
Okay, kind of a downer, but this was the second story.
Thousands of women across West Africa have lost their freedom because of a practice called chokoshi, and it's still happening.
Yeah, that was from a film called My Stolen Childhood. Number three in the BBC videos.
For months now, images like these have been pouring out of Cameroon on social media. Some show burning villages. Others record acts of torture and killing.
Okay, so Africa doesn't seem to be doing that well. Or the BBC documentary producers realize funding lays in showing the ways in which Africa could be improved. Let us say a little room for improvement. A horseman abatement program is afoot, a hoof. But this is really a positive day. Today is a positive day. So ignore Twitter, because I looked and trending there is Jeffrey Epstein, hashtag Trump is a white supremacist, hashtag protect Terrence K. Williams. No, don't. Come on. The biggest news is that one of the world's most horrific pestilences has been cured. Please pay attention and please be pleased. And that's it for today's show. Pierre Bien-Aimé and Daniel Schrader produced The Gist. They choose facts over truth. They choose authenticity over realness. They choose negotiation over diplomacy. And they embrace the call not to hug too much. And what next? Right there on your feed, right now. What next? The changing demographics of the migrants who are fueling the border crisis. The Gist. Ben Franklin, who signed the Declaration of Independence, said, "We must all hang together, or surely we will hang alone." Because Franklin knew that the British were adept executioners, and Ben Franklin didn't want to be very well hung. Am I right, Scranton? Oom-peru-de-peru-du-peru, and thanks for listening.